Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So today I would like to give a talk about again about sapatthana conditions, but today I want to give a talk about two conditions which are, so to say, a couplet. Two conditions which, so to say, make up one duality, or one dual condition. And that is, in Pali, the two patana conditions that are in Pali called atipachaya and natipachaya, which can be translated as something like presence and absence, or as existence and non-existence. Two words which maybe for anyone but the philosopher are almost two simple ideas, two primitive ideas that many one would ask or would wonder, what is there to talk about? Or what is there to talk about? Being and non-being. No, but I'm determined to talk about, first I was determined to understand, and now I'm determined to talk about all of the sapatthana conditions, and I'm trying to give some meaningful talk about each of the sapatthana conditions. So I try to make up something of what you can do with being and non-being, or existence and non-existence. So let me try start systematically following the Abhidhamma scheme, and then hopefully I can make it sound more natural as time goes on. So the patana conditions build up on the basic items of the Abhidhamma, which are mind, matter, consciousness, and nibbana. But as mentioned so many times before, nibbana I usually excluded from the treatment. So let's see in a systematic manner where we can find some meaningful truth regarding existence and non-existence in relation to the first item of matter, which is the four elements. So we have stated that the four elements are earth, water, fire, wind. So we have described before various characteristics of each element which describe their existence. The existence of solidity, the existence of heaviness, and the existence of form is sort of what shows the presence or existence of the earth element. But we do notice things like unsubstantiality, things like lack of weight, and you can say also the lack of form. So some of these you may describe to the presence of the air element, but actually it is really, if you want to think clearly about the four elements, these are the things that define the absence of that element. Maybe more so you have it with other elements. For example, dryness is really only just the absence of the water element. Darkness is the absence of light. coldness is the absence of heat, which means the absence of the fire element. Stillness is the absence of movement, which means the absence of the air element. So that's quite pretty straightforward a statement. But then we would ask, well, but what's the good of it? What for talking about that in a Dhamma talk? For grasping this, you sort of have to grasp the idea of the Abhidhamma, of trying to explain the wholeness of existence. These things that I just mentioned, if we pay careful attention to our experience of the world, what we experience around us, I went deeper into that already in other talks and in my book, that you basically can explain in some meaningful manner the wholeness of sense experience in matters of the four elements. But you can do it more to rough, so to say, by thinking of the four elements in matters of presence and absence. So if you really want to practice meditation and you want to develop your mindfulness, this is one way of how to pay attention to your experience, by sort of classifying everything you experience in matters of the four elements, in matters of their characteristics, and in matters of their presence or absence. So this is whether you're looking into your body or whether you're looking with your eyes open at the trees or a meditation hall, if you're meditating in a meditation hall, or nature or other people. This is one way you can not just perceive what is in front of you or what's inside of you, but you can sort of gain knowledge with it. It's quite a little bit similar to if you would learn an instrument, for example. At some point you want to sort of express every emotion, or at least every deep emotion that wells up in you, or wells up in you. You would like to give that expression with your instrument. So some instruments have 5-6 strings, for example. So you would seek to express your deeper feelings by means of 5-6 strings on a wooden something, on some instrument. So the idea is very similar with contemplating the four elements. Not just you're looking, you're not just perceiving, but you're engaging with what you're perceiving. And this way you feel more, you become more yourself. You learn to express yourself with your knowledge, so to say. You learn to give meaning to what you perceive, and you learn to in the end to play with it, because it's not just about becoming aware of what is there, but also about finding a way of relating to it in a manner that it brings greater harmony into your experience. So you're not just sort of labeling what is there, but by labeling, if you label an unpleasant experience as being a manifestation of the fire element, for example, then by giving it a name, you take away its mysteriousness, so to say. You take away a certain power it might have over your mind. So if you give it a name, then you made the first step in controlling it, or in preventing it from controlling you. So you give it a name. This is just fire element, and then you try to think further. Whatever you know about the fire element, you try to think about. You try to integrate it in your experience of pain, for example. Not just as one example, not that I say that pain is particularly important to experience in meditation, but almost everyone will have to go through pain when trying to become a good meditator. So what you're doing is that the moment you give it a name, you start to calm down. You said, okay, it's okay, you know, it's just fire element. And then whatever you know about the fire element will help you to think further, not to stay with the experience for longer. So that at that time, your mind rules over matter. Or you can even say your mind learns to escape from matter. But it will also mean that you realize that the whole thing is about gaining knowledge, gaining wisdom from your experience. It's not about endurance. Endurance may at times be part of it, but it's not the essence of it. So endurance only if you have another set of ideas that I might treat in a treatment on the mind, which we also can then treat in matters of existence and non-existence. But the idea is that it's about having good ideas in relation to what you're experiencing. You don't want to. Meditation is not something that is just sit down and do nothing or something. You need knowledge in order to meditate intelligently. So, but if you have this kind of classification scheme, for example, as the four elements, then whenever you run out of knowledge, you sort of can try to create new knowledge. Try to your next sense perception. One thing you have no good idea anymore about, then you take another sense perception. Maybe the wind that blows at your body, and then you try to think of what does the presence of the wind element can teach you, or how it can help you to make your meditation something more agreeable, make your meditation better. If you start noticing ever new things, then you can ever longer and longer keep going your meditation. Which does not necessarily mean that you keep longer and longer. You have to longer and longer sit or make that as a determination. Sometimes in order to keep going your meditation, you have to get up from your meditation seat. But you do it with intelligence. You do it in order to find a new way of balancing out problems, or a new way of gaining new knowledge and experience, and not to run away from something. And of course, you don't, when you come to a point where you feel you had enough of the four elements, you learn something about it, and you're not just jumping from one thing to the other, but you gained some experience with the four elements that you gave it a fair try, and now you really feel that you want to try something else. Then you can go on to the body, or to the element of life, which is sort of the next higher form of matter. So in matters of the four elements, what we are hoping to cultivate is the experience of balance of the elements, basically. We can express it this way, or we can also express it in another way. We want to experience the presence of stability and the absence of instability. That is in relation to the earth element. In relation to the water element, we want clarity, and we want to purify ourselves to make any form of diluteness or unclarity that we might perceive non-existent. In relation to the fire element, now we want to have the presence of light, and we want to try to come to the non-existence of all darkness within ourselves. And in relation to the wind element, now we hope to experience the presence of subtleness, and we're trying to get rid of all forms of restless movement, which we try to lead these into non-existence. So basically, you're making experiments in your meditation with the aim of finding the most perfect existence of the elements, when we are talking about the elements, as well as to lead your perhaps former dissatisfying or unsatisfactory experience of these elements into non-existence. So if you reach some conclusion with that, now I just already started mentioning before something about the life element, which will be the next sort of step of building up further knowledge. So now if you're able to recognize these qualities of the elements, and as well as the absence of their particular describing qualities or characterizing qualities, then you may be able to notice something which is more subtle. For some people it is more natural to experience it, but they usually have already some intuition in regard to these elements, and that is the life element. So now obviously, in relation to the life element, what we want is we want more of the experience of life. We want to feel more alive, and to some degree we may start meditating because we do not feel very alive. That may be one of the reasons why we want to meditate. We are drained of life, and we are trying to find the life, the fount of life within ourselves. And to find that knowledge of the elements will be helpful. But once we found it, we don't want to lose it again, and we don't want to just waste it away. And the way to prevent the just wasting away of it, and the way of cultivating the experience of greater aliveness, is by studying this life element. So one thing that people often notice, we can describe that as a stage in meditation, or people in meditation retreats, sometimes after a few days or so, they start getting there of feeling more alive. And one thing that they will notice is that this life itself possesses a certain intelligence to it. So maybe when they're not meditating, for example during mealtime, they will find that this life knows itself what is best for it. This life itself knows itself what it needs to grow further, and it knows what is kind of destructive to it. So if you're nice, if you start feeling more alive, you know, for example, and then you're going to your meal, automatically you will be more sensitive, and you know, the life within you will feel more attracted to the healthy things, and it will be more repelled by anything unhealthy. So that is one of the qualities that comes about through that condition of greater life and more presence of life. And when you start realizing that, then you realize that many of your life's problems come about due to lack of aliveness. Many of your problems cease, your manifold problems cease in life when you start becoming more alive, and when you're starting to cultivate that. You cease to desire things that are bad for you, generally speaking. And you don't need to ask the doctor, and you don't need to read lots of health magazines in order to know what is good for you. Because if you study this life, it will tell you, you will find that it knows. Not like animals, you find, sometimes when they're sick, they do a fasting for a day by themselves, or they find the right plants and eat some grass or some plant, which you would wonder who told them that that's the right medicine for them. But they know. And this is because his inner life knows already many things. And if we study that with our conscious mind, then our studies and our knowledge becomes more a personal thing, a thing that possesses true relevance for you or for us. Which is quite a very different thing from book knowledge and studying things from the books, where you have to force yourself to get the things into your brain. But of course, the presence of greater life sometimes also can produce problems. Or we might rather say new challenges, because it is not something to run away from, but something that you have to learn, you have to go through. So if your the life element in you increases, then it will also increase sometimes for people. For example, the sexual drive becomes much stronger, or the drive to react violently to things that are perceived as disturbing and as being threatening to the life. So that presents the challenge of this study of the life, that you want to learn to work with more life, with more intense life. You want to attain to greater presence. You want to attain to greater presence of life. But in order to do that, you need to learn the lessons. It's not happens all at once. You will make mistakes that you did not make before. But you will also learn things which you did not knew before, and things which you don't as easily forget as things that you learn in school and from the books. And then once you learned some amount of the important lessons of life, of the life within you, which you will also the thing, usually you cannot separate the two so easily. If you want to learn about life, you cannot just study it inside yourself and neglecting any kind of study of it outside yourself. So, but once you learn some lessons and you learned a little bit what it means when life is present and what it means when life is absent, while you're doing such study, then you slowly will inevitably enter the domain of the mind. And there, maybe one of the first things that you will notice is that, you know, the presence of certain things in the body conditions the presence and absence of certain things in the mind. So your body comes to greater life, then slowly also the mind will come to greater life. Now, your tummy is filled with food and you have a good digestion, then you feel like having vigor, which may express itself as joy. It may express itself also as, you have more vigor to fight your enemy, you're more angry. Or it may manifest as, depending also where the overflow of life is sort of becoming stagnant. If you have a strong heart, it may result in a strong anger or strong joy. But if, for example, your sexual organs get this overflow of vigor, then you start to have strong sexual desire. And here again, we may realize the importance for meditation of understanding and learning to perceive this life element within the body, where depending on where the life element is kind of overflowing, what it sort of feeds, there will come up certain topics for the mind. But equally, if you're a good meditator and you learn to sort of control this life element, then you can make adjustments to it. You can see to it that it does not excessively overflow within your sexual organs. And if it stimulates certain mind states that arise primarily in the heart, then you can make adjustments of either you starve the mind state by remaining there with your mindfulness and trying to kind of produce heat with a sense of effort, or you sort of relax further. Now the mind state remains somewhat, you feel it in your heart, but you pay attention to it and you relax your chest, you relax your heart, you feel a more refined energy is moving further upwards. So there you see the presence of what conditions what you might want, the presence of what conditions, what condition of the body conditions, for example, mindfulness, conditions creativity or imagination and such kind of things. And these mind states then in turn again will also condition your life experiences and your capacity to control these mind states is almost equivalent to controlling your life. For example, if you radiate calm, if you are calm and you radiate calm, then you will also have a soothing and calming effect on others. And you will find that your environment becomes also more calm and peaceful. The people surrounding you start to talk to you in a more calm manner. Good people become interested in you, while bad and angry people may have less interest in you because you're not the type of person they can easily start a quarrel with. So you're sort of becoming boring for them. But equally, the other way around, if you're an angry person, if angry mind states arise in you, their presence will also condition the presence of certain things in life, in the outside life. If you're a strongly angry person, then people, either they avoid you, or you're finding yourself more often engaged in quarrels. And the opposite will be true for the absence of anger, or the absence of calm, or the absence of love. If you're void of love, then you're not likely, it's not likely that other people love you. So that are some of the ways we can study the mind in relation to the condition of presence and the condition of absence. There are probably better ways of considering about this. So I invite everyone who listens to this talk and who wants to understand the Abhidhamma deeply to find some better way of contemplating the mind in relation to the condition of presence and absence, and go on to a consideration of consciousness. Now, consciousness, the way it is usually understood, that is, as awareness of something, requires the presence of something in order to become present itself. That is at least how things are in the normal human condition, or in Abhidhamma terms, in regard to the sense sphere world. And that is actually precisely the reason for the existence of the senses. From a spiritual perspective, or from the perspective of consciousness, the sense sphere world is a training ground for consciousness. That is, beings who reached a certain stage of development have that as their natural task in life arising, as their natural meaning in life arising, that they learn to attain greater presence of consciousness. And that is actually something that is very important to understand for a meditator, that you must have trained to a considerable degree to be aware of the objects of the senses, to designate them, to give them meaning, to think about them. These are all faculties of consciousness, the capacity to be aware, the capacity to designate, to give names to things, and the capacity to think about things, and the capacity to evolve ideas about things. And for human being, we are born as humans because that is where we are at, where our spiritual evolution, so to say, is just now. So that is where we have to start learning to be aware. And only when that has become well functional, when consciousness has learned to remain present within the sense sphere world and is not continuously drifting from here to there like a ghost, only then we can start to talk about meditation and the development of mind, which means also the development of consciousness. Before that, you take away the objects of the senses, then you take away the ground for consciousness. You take away the basis for consciousness. Because consciousness has to develop gradually the capacity to be aware of subtler and subtler things. So actually, in between the condition of being able to be to remain present in relation to the objects of the senses, your life happenings, your experiences of life, and being able to meditate, the stage in between is where you learn to be aware both of the coarse things of the senses, but equally of subtler feelings within yourself. That is part of the training of virtue. You become aware of how something feels if you do something bad, especially if you do something that you perceive to be bad, that you know to be bad. Then within yourself there will arise some unpleasant sensation. Something maybe ordinary people get rid of with alcohol or with other new sense stimulation. But a person who tries to really train in virtue, he starts to pay attention to this. And this is precisely what is cultivated further in the practice of meditation. This kind of inner sense, what is right and what is wrong. And this kind of inner faculty that develops of making adjustments, preventing yourself from doing what is wrong, even if the impulse arises within, and learning to further get into, further develop the things that you know to be true, that you know to be right. And when you develop these two things, this inner sense of knowing what is right and wrong, and that faculty that is able to respond to this and is able to make adjustments, then your consciousness learns to be present in a subtler world. This subtler world is always there, but without those faculties and without this inner sense, it is non-existent for you. So, but while you are developing these already when practicing virtue or when being determined on becoming virtuous, you do this much more specific when you're meditating. And if you're meditating properly, you make decisions in regard to what is right and what is wrong, in regard to what you're experiencing within yourself, and then you make adjustments. You burn away whatever you perceive to be wrong, and you see to it that you don't get distracted, and that you find some way of further cultivating it if desirable things arise. And this is a cultivation of fine material consciousness. The sense sphere consciousness requires the senses, or requires the objects of the senses in order to be present. And when the objects of the senses are not there, then the sense sphere consciousness also disappears. It goes into non-existence. And you fall asleep or become dull. And a similar thing happens with the fine material consciousness. The fine material consciousness requires also still some basis based on which it can function. That is, finer feelings, finer perceptions. And as long as these are there, the fine material consciousness may be present. But when these disappear, then also the fine material consciousness will disappear. Either it gives way again to the sense sphere consciousness, or if it develops further, then it may function purely in the realm of mind. Now this is everything after fourth jhana, is the world of mind, the Arupa world. And in order that consciousness may remain present in that world of mind, it needs to be able to function purely on a level of ideas. It needs to be able to interact with ideas. Just like if a baby is born into the human world or into the sensory world, it has to learn many things in order that it can remain present, that it can be fully human, that it can acquire a fully human consciousness, so to say. That is a task of the sensory world, that is a task of a person who is born as a human. He learns to walk, he learns to talk, and then slowly he learns to remain conscious or remain continuously present, or at least continuous enough to not get involved in any sense fear problems anymore. Only then it makes sense to go to the next step of learning to walk, so to say, learning to act in the fine material world, which is equally a difficult task, as it is difficult for a child to learn to walk and to talk and so on. It is just the same with each new stage of being, each new stage of existence. Actually, it is usually much more difficult because most people who would listen to a talk like this, most people who are interested in meditation, they have had thousands of lives as a human. In succession, I mean. Which means maybe they had so many billions of human lives, but maybe thousands of lives on this planet, we can say. So with each new form of existence, there will be this task of learning to become present, learning to master that form of existence by growing further and further in presence. While if consciousness loses its already acquired capacity to remain present, for example, if you are getting into drugs and alcohol, you try to solve your problems by reducing consciousness so that you're not, that you can escape these problems, so that there will be an increase in the absence of consciousness, then whatever has been gained in matters of consciousness will be lost. But as a being is not a singular thing, so to say, but is made up of five khandhas, five parts: matter, mind, feeling, consciousness, and perception. So these are not equal. And in fact, we can say there's a certain hierarchy amongst them. And the longer the higher parts are present, the longer the lower, we can say, the coarser parts of us are absent. So if you learn how to think properly, if you cultivate subtler feelings, if you refine your capacity to perceive, then you will learn to live less and less only in a world of matter. And the more matter rules your life, the less spiritual you are. And that also equally means the more dukkha you have, the more suffering you have. While on the other hand side, if you learn to become more and more present, if your consciousness acquires a greater and greater capacity to remain present with whatever life circumstances there are, the more spiritual you become, and consequently also the less you're controlled by matter. So matter gradually becomes only something that is perceived, not that is really touching you and controlling you. And of course, the higher you get, then gradually you only perceive more and more only subtler forms of matter. And ultimately, you try to transcend matter altogether.
And maybe that is a good conclusion for this talk. I hope that this exposition on being and non-being, or presence and absence, was a clear enough exposition on the subject matter. And I hope that at least some of the listeners gained some new understanding from it. And with that, I end this talk.